Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House spokesman Josh Earnest today chiding Donald Trump over his dogged insistence that Russia did not hack our elections, saying, "Mr. Trump obviously knows that Russia was engaged in malicious cyber activity that was helping him and hurting Secretary Clinton's campaign, and it might be time to not attack the intelligence community, but actually be supportive of a thorough, transparent, rigorous, non-political investigation into what actually happened." A veteran U.S. intelligence operative, Malcolm Nance, the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, joins us to discuss how it has been obvious for a long time that Russian hacking has been going on, yet only now are we learning that Vladimir Putin conducted a hate-filled vendetta against Hillary Clinton, personally handling the operation to help elect Donald Trump and defeat the woman against whom he harbors a bitter grudge. Then with the fall of Aleppo to Russian, Iranian, and Assad regime forces, we will look into the major geostrategic shift underway in the Middle East, with what amounts to the so-called Shia Crescent becoming a reality, with Iran, through its proxies, now effectively in control of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver and author of The Syria Dilemma, joins us to discuss how the folly of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's war in Iraq has rewarded Iran at the expense of Saudi Arabia and possibly in the near future, Israel. Then finally, we will speak with a former Swedish diplomat who served in Moscow and was an advisor to the Russian government, Anders Usland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University. He joins us to discuss Putin's next target now that he has his man Trump in the White House, Germany's Angela Merkel, and her party up for re-election. With Putin's cyber warriors now switching their attention to sabotaging the German elections, we will examine the Russian troll farms now deployed to spread fake news and anti-immigrant paranoia to help elect right-wing and neo-Nazi parties in Germany's 2017 election. And joining me now is Malcolm Nance, who is a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who has been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
Glad to be here.
So, Malcolm, it feels like there's a huge queue. I mean, you've been, I think, incredibly vindicated being ahead of the curve here, while apparently the president himself, Barack Obama, sat on a lot of this information. Clearly, the Republicans didn't want it to come out. There's a division between the CIA, who believe the issue, of course, is about intent. They believe that there was an intent to tip the scales to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. The FBI apparently don't go along with that, but they go along with the basic premise that the Russians hacked the elections. So let's begin with the context. There are other factors, the use of Facebook on the part of Trump, which is very effective, Hillary Clinton's poor campaigning non-existent campaigning in the important Rust Belt states, and the letter from the FBI director. So given how close it was, is any one factor tipping the scale here, or is it a combination of factors?
You know, you could always say it's a combination of factors. But, you know, the first day that I mentioned this incident, the hacking, as an actual attack on the United States and its electoral process, to where the Russians were trying to tip the scale in favor of one person, that was on July 25th, the first day of the Democratic National Committee convention. And, you know, it became patently clear that the WikiLeaks documents which were being put out were part of a scripted intelligence operation. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, Hillary Clinton lost fair and square. Well, if you look at the word clouds of all the words associated in the media with Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, you'll see that the word email takes up 50% of the space of her work cloud of media coverage of Hillary Clinton was on emails. And the definitive time that the emails came out, which was almost a feeding frenzy, was the WikiLeaks releases. On the first day of the Democratic National Convention, the releases were timed and the information was scaled so that it would cause a split right down the middle of the Democratic Party. It would split the Bernie Sanders supporters from the Hillary Clinton supporters, which it did, and would peel off votes. And from that day right up to Election Day, there were a series of highly sequenced releases of emails, not just from the Democratic National Committee, but also from supporters of Hillary Clinton and people on her staff. The only way, if you notice, the only emails which were actually released from Hillary Clinton were copies or responses from other people who were hacked. There's no evidence that Hillary Clinton's actual email server was hacked, but Gmail was hacked. The Democratic Committee was hacked, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign, the Democratic Congressional Campaign. Even, you know, Lindsey Graham and Colin Powell, they were all hacked. And they all had one thing in common. They were distinctly anti-Trump. And that is where the CIA could draw their conclusion based on the context of all the data which was coming in, and also based on the precedent that Russian intelligence had been doing this for years, and successfully during the cyber age, by stealing information and releasing it in order to damage politicians. However, this operation was massive. It was from top down, a very, very large intelligence operation intended to damage Hillary Clinton to elect Donald Trump.
Well, NBC News is reporting, of course, that Vladimir Putin had hands-on involvement. And I had heard reports earlier that there was even dissent within the Russian intelligence services, and that explains why Putin's chief of staff was fired, because he objected. He thought it was too reckless to try and destabilize the American elections and pick a candidate. And also Medvedev, apparently, the prime minister, also complained to Putin, thought it was reckless, and both of them, and he's been marginalized. My understanding is that Putin's surrounded now by younger kind of yes men, and that many of them didn't experience the Soviet Union and what a mess that was and why it collapsed under its own weight. And therefore, they believe this victimization theory that Putin has managed to convince the Russian people that the West is out to get them.
Well, Vladimir Putin was an officer of the KGB. And then he later would become the head of the FSK and the FSB, which is the successor organization to the KGB. The KGB without the border guards, right? But one thing that's interesting, and it comes to your point about Putin sidelining his senior management, who all remember the Soviet Union era, Putin elevated during the first years of the new FSB, when he became premier, he elevated FSB and ex-KGB officers almost to the point, as a matter of fact, the new director of the FSB refers to them as the new Russian nobility. And Vladimir Putin required all oligarchs who were under his roof, right, who were in his good graces, to have senior FSB and KGB officers on staff. He is a product of his career field. He is literally a spy master in chief who just happens to be controlling a nation and has atomic weapons. So, of course, for him, a former Soviet spy, this would have been a culminating, pinnacle intelligence operation that the Russians certainly dreamed of in the Soviet era, as far back as Lenin and Stalin, possibly getting, someone who is sympathetic to their cause. But Putin saw that possibly very early on that the Americans would fall under their own weight with their opposition to Barack Obama. And the way that the nation had been polarized, all it would require is for someone who had, who saw Russia's point of view. And surprisingly, that person came up. I don't believe that Donald Trump came up initially as Putin's mark, you know, to make him president. I think Putin just saw him as a highly entertaining person who understood the American street when he came to Russia in 2012. But as a spy master, someone who recruited agents, ran agents into West Germany when he was stationed in East Germany, he knew how to use what we call the MICE theory of agent recruitment, right? The MICE doctrine of agent recruitment. You make a new agent by tantalizing them with money. Well, Russia had the oligarchs, and they surrounded Trump with oligarchs in 2012. And people with real money, hundreds of billions of dollars, not $1 billion. Second was the ideology. You have to convince that person that you're working in their interest and your interest. And this may explain why Donald Trump's entire political and, you know, foreign policy ideology is mirror image to that of Russia's. Then you have co-option, where you get that person to work for you, even though they may not know they're working for you, and or coercion, where that person, and that's the last thing you want to do, that person doesn't want to work for you, fine, you show them all the blackmail information that you have on them. And finally, you massage, you play their ego. And Donald Trump is a narcissistic, you know, almost, you know, pathological personality. He's, you know, some people say he's a sociopath. This person requires constant attention, focused solely on himself. And there is a quote in my book by Yuri Bezmenov, an ex-KGB officer, who says, this is the personality that KGB were always taught to look out for. Conservatives, not liberals, and people who were self-absorbed, greedy, and who needed constant attention, and the recruiter would give them that attention. When Donald Trump started to become popular in 2015, Putin, even though the field still had 15 other Republicans on the stage, endorsed Donald Trump in December of 2015 by essentially saying, I like Trump. He's a very, you know, colorful person. And Trump took off from there. And it's fascinating, but somehow, Donald Trump, when it became clear that he was going to be the nominee for the Republican Party, the machinery was already in place. That the, you know, the FSB had already been in the Democratic Committee's servers for over a year, and now they took that information and assisted Donald Trump's win.
So what do you make of these rumors? You mentioned in MICE blackmail, and there's been a persistent rumor that when Donald Trump was in Moscow in 2013 for the Miss Universe contest, there is footage of him at nightclubs with a whole bunch of young, pretty Russian girls. But the rumor is that he fell for a Putin honey trap later that evening at the Ritz Hotel in the presidential suite with a bunch of girls. There's been so much smoke about that. Has it ever come across your transom?
Well, no, nothing official, of course, but I don't need any of that information. I mean, I don't need any video. You know, as a person, I worked at the National Security Agency. I've worked within the human and signals intelligence apparatus. I've done close-quarter surveillance. A person like Donald Trump, who is a very rich American, a television and media personality, he would not escape the gaze of the FSB because they don't know. They don't know whether he's a hostile agent who is being run by the United States or he's just one of those people where blackmail would be very, very useful at some future event. So a person like him, who uses no secure telephones, no secure internet, no secure BlackBerry or text, right, would be just a dream for an intercept operator from Russia's version of NSA, which is called the Special Communications and Information Service, or Spetsnaz. They would have just sat there and just vacuum cleaned his life. And, of course, they would have easily been able to collect any email or listen to any business transactions that he have, and I'm certain that the dossier on Donald Trump is about a mile long. On the other hand, you have GRU, Russian military intelligence, and the FSB, Russian security services, who would have had him surrounded with surveillance and possibly his hotel room with technical intelligence that even with expert American technical intelligence people shy of the U.S. of NSA or Cyber Command, they would not have been able to find cameras. They would not have been able to find, listening devices. I think Donald Trump has been just a boon in intelligence collection for the FSB. That being said, there may be a lot of information. You know, he loves to go out. He loves the nightclub. He likes to party. And I don't think he would care about that. I think he's so shameless that he would view any video of him having a sexual conquest as a mark of honor, as a badge of honor. But on the other hand, the money that he may owe to Russia, and there's rumors that it's as high as $440 million. And there's another rumor that he owes China as much as $600 million. That would destroy him if that information were to come out, especially if it turns out that any of that money was loaned to him through the real estate market of Russia in the way that money was loaned to Marie Le Pen in terms of fostering right-wing agitation. The former Soviet Union was very, very good at two things. Money and honey traps, right? Women agents who would have sex with you. I'm on the board of the International Spy Museum in Washington, and we have an ex-KGB general, Oleg Kalugin. And Oleg Kalugin said famously, and in the West, you asked your young men to stand up for your nation. In the East, we asked our women to lie down for it. So, right. You know, money and sex certainly would not be the things that would make Donald Trump blink, but certainly exposing his debts may explain why he is so obsequious. He is literally servile to Vladimir Putin. And that, I mean, would raise the eyebrows of any counterintelligence officer. You would think there's something dirty here.
Well, indeed. I know Oleg Kalugin, and he told me that, by the way, that one of the things that we've missed over here is that at the very end, after Yeltsin had promoted Putin, Yeltsin realized what a terrible mistake he'd made, that this guy was really bad news. Let's talk a little bit, though, just because you and Malcolm Nance, you are ahead of the crowd here in terms of nailing the Russian hacking in your new book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Well, you may be able to change the title and say how they did steal, frankly.
That book did come out a month before the election.
Sure.
It was written 4 months before the election.
Right, so. Right. No, you definitely were ahead of the curve. But the thing that makes me nuts is that the first people who came out with this information were not political types. They're tech types. These people like CrowdStrike and Mandiant who did the internet forensics, they don't lie. They can't lie. They're all in competition with each other. If they make one little technical mistake, they get pounced on. So the idea that they are the first people to tell us that somehow didn't get everybody in the press and in the political world to realize that this stuff is for real, you know? I mean, what the hell's wrong here? And you got the president sitting on this stuff because he thinks it's going to be too partisan to put the information out, and you got the Republicans suppressing it. I mean, my God, you know, when Mike Morrell, the former deputy director of the CIA, says that this is the equivalent of a cyber 9/11 attack, I mean, what more evidence do you want?
Well, you're absolutely right about the case for the evidence. CrowdStrike was the company that was brought in to do the cyber sweep up on the DNC. And, you know, several other companies had seen the exact fingerprints of Russian intelligence. CrowdStrike nicknamed the two entities that they had tracked, which were still up and active inside the DNC, with the name Fancy Bear, which belonged to the GRU, and Cozy Bear, which belonged to the FSB. Now, these aren't individuals. These are the names of the malware delivery packages, or as I like to refer to them as, the cyber weapon systems, which were inside these servers, draining it of everything that exists. But they have very distinct fingerprints. And these fingerprints were seen in numerous other operations that we knew Russian intelligence had been working. The, ATP 28 and 29, Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, had been responsible for shutting down three power plants in the Ukraine just the year before. I mean, literally taking control of the power plants while they were in operation and seizing them going through all the exact motions that a power plant operator would need to shut them down, and then cut power for 100,000 people in the Ukraine. They had been seen in the hacking of the German parliament, an attack, a cyber attack on French television, which actually used a false flag claiming that they were ISIS. So these entities had been seen in numerous parts of the world before. And, you know, no matter how you try, there are always going to be little fingerprints left behind. And their servers, of course, were tracked back to Russia, you know, to the headquarters of the FSB. So it wasn't very hard.
Well, just in closing, Malcolm Nance, my understanding is that these troll farms or troll factories that the FSB operate in Russia, and I'm not sure of exactly what the arrangements are, but, you know, the sad thing is, and I've worked on the Soviet Union on arms control for years and have great affection for the Russian people, and it's just heartbreaking that their freedom has been taken away from them after so many decades of communism. And, you know, but you have a bunch of gangsters, and you do have, as you pointed out earlier, this geopolitical phenomenon that we're not used to and certainly have never dealt with before, which is the combination of organized crime and nuclear weapons.
Right.
But on top of that, it seems like when you've got a bunch of gangsters in charge of a country, the morality just gets eroded overnight. And that leads to, of course, to the doping of all of their athletes and stuff like that. So, to my mind, it's not difficult to imagine that they've organized all of these kind of criminals as a kind of adjunct to the state. And you've got...
They have.
Is that what's happened with these troll farms? Because they're now turning their attention on Germany, I understand.
The trolls of Olinka, which New York Times did some excellent reporting on, which actually tracked down these rooms, the one in St. Petersburg, and then there's others that are subcontractors. And all they were was American-speaking or English-speaking people who would just go in there and create bots that and accounts that would pretend to be Trump supporters. And I actually have been attacked by them. And the interesting component of it was once I was attacked by the bots, you know, by the troll farm, I was immediately attacked by Sputnik, Russia's version of Pravda today, right? You know, calling me a hacker and a shill for Hillary Clinton, you know? And so with these false entities that pretend to be American citizens, who the English can sometimes be very good and other times be horribly bad, these are fall into a category that we call militia bears, to where these are people who are either loyal to the state or who are paid subcontractors to an intelligence agency. But on the other hand, there's another component. You were just saying, we call them the criminal bears. These are the Russian hackers, like the ones who may have hacked Yahoo and stolen a billion passwords. Well, when you get all the passwords, you can now specifically target individuals like Malcolm Nance at Yahoo.com, right? Well, I don't have an account there, so they move on to the next. But they, if they have the passwords and they get into people's emails, they can go, you know, scan through for credit cards and all sorts of information. The Russian criminal bear cyber teams have been stealing billions through legal and illegal cyber activities, like stealing credit cards and laundering information and selling off information. And you know that little trick where your computer locks up ransomware, right? Mm-hmm. And you got to send them money to get it open.
Right.
That has been a Russian phenomenon for almost a decade.
Right, and they did that to a hospital here in Los Angeles, which is, of course, the poor hospital had to pay because all their patient records were at stake. They're ruthless. Well, we could talk a lot, and I'm very grateful to the work that you've done, Malcolm, because you've been ahead of the curve, and I think this is one of the biggest stories of the year, if not the decade, or the I won't say the century, but it's a huge story, and I thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to have been here.
And again, I've been speaking with Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who's been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how the Shia crescent has become a reality with Iran now in control of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. And his forthcoming book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
And as Aleppo is poised to fall and there have been atrocities, I understand that Hezbollah were the main reason why the truce broke down just in the last day or so. But clearly, this is a victory for Assad, the Russians, and Iran. And I think it sort of almost indicates a huge geopolitical shift that I'm surprised that more analysts and scholars haven't noticed. We've heard about the fears that the Sunni, particularly the Saudis, have over the Shia crescent, where Iran sort of extends its influence all the way to the Mediterranean. Hasn't that already happened in effect? Iran's proxies basically have created the Shia crescent, with Iran having influence over Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
I would agree with that, Ian. I think, you know, Iran is one of the big victors here in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia's attempt to try and stop and roll back Iran, particularly in the context of Syria, I think, has failed. And I think events in Aleppo are going to be recognized as a turning point for Iran's hegemonic ambitions in the Middle East prevailing over those of Saudi Arabia, which has its own hegemonic ambitions. And one reason why this hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves, as you rightly noted, is because I think most of the global attention has been on the United States and the rise of Donald Trump and the new Trump-Putin alliance that is forming. And it does have implications for the Middle East, but I think that's where most of the, you know, attention has been in recent months. But I think all of these events do not bode well for the future stability of the Middle East. If you just stop and think about Syria for a moment, the conquest of Aleppo and the attempt by the Assad regime, backed by Russia and Iran, to reassert control over that country is going to, I think, ensure greater instability and chaos for months and years to come. If you stop and think about it, think about the question of stability in Assad for a moment. Assad is overwhelmingly responsible for a politicide that is, characterized by state-sanctioned war crimes and borderline genocidal activity. And to think that the individual responsible for those atrocities can be a stabilizing force in any long-term view of the Middle East is, I think, wishful thinking. I think what we're going to see is a low-level insurgency that will destabilize the rest of the Middle East for years to come. And, you know, what will happen at the end of it is anyone's guess. So I think these are very ominous developments that don't bode well, not only for the Middle East, but I think they have huge consequences for the spread and the appeal of radical militancy in the Middle East, which will then, I think, manifest itself, as we've already seen in Europe and in the United States, with, you know, greater appeals for an easier ability for radical groups to appeal now and recruit young Muslims to their cause as a result of these events that we've been seeing in Syria.
Well, if the fighters, the besieged fighters in Aleppo, are able to get to Idlib, which is where they're essentially, that's where the deal will take them in bus convoys. Idlib, of course, is controlled by the Islamic State. And most, I think, of these fighters are more secular from the so-called Free Syrian Army or what's left of it. So they're not even going to be welcome, are they, in Idlib?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I suspect they will, if they want to have any, they will be under the control of those radical extremist groups, ISIS and, you know, Al-Qaeda in Idlib province that control that territory. And I suspect many of them are going to have no other option but to sign on to those existing radical Islamist movements if they want to continue to resist the Assad regime. So that's one indication of how one of the big victors in the conquest of Aleppo are ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They'll have new recruits that they can easily incorporate into their organization. You know, the civilian population will be caught in the middle, at least those that are able to flee. And so, you know, you're right to point that out. I mean, I think it just highlights how the net winners here in the Middle East are ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I think we'll see that very, very quickly in the context of what will be taking place in Idlib province.
So let's talk about these big strategic and geopolitical shifts underway, where, in effect, Shiite Crescent, or the Shia Crescent, as the Saudis have been concerned about, has in fact become a reality, that Iran now dominates Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And, of course, the chips began to fall, the dominoes, if you will, that led to this empowerment of Iran are entirely laid at the doorstep of George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld for the folly of the Iraq war. Saddam Hussein, as dreadful as he was at least a check and balance against Iran's territorial ambitions. And that we took that cork out of the bottle, and the chips have fallen as they have. And at the end of the day, this is what I find extraordinary, Nader, and I'd like you to focus on it if you could. The incredible irony is that the neocons who cooked up this ridiculous war in Iraq were all doing it, as far as I can see, because of their adherence to the Likud party in Israel. Yet, when the Shia Crescent becomes a reality, when Iran is clearly in control of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, right next door to Israel, the Israelis are going to wake up. Their mortal enemies at their doorstep. So don't you find that deeply ironic?
You know, there are deep tensions there in the worldview of neocons and the worldview of, you know, Netanyahu and his supporters. I think from Netanyahu's perspective, he's very happy with the unfolding of events in the Middle East, largely because global attention is no longer on what Israel is doing in Gaza, what Israel is doing in the West Bank. All of the attention is on ISIS, Syria, Iraq. And so that's a net gain for Netanyahu and his supporters, who can say, you know, don't criticize us for what we're doing. There are bigger problems in the region that you should be focusing on. In terms of the neocons and their worldview, I think in many ways they are increasingly, you know, irrelevant in a world that's dominated by Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. I think, you know, that wing of the Republican Party, while still having some, I think, you know, presence in the Trump administration, and figures such as John Bolton, who will be the, you know, number two man in the State Department, are now being overtaken by more sort of extremist civilizational conservatives, as Peter Beinart wrote in a recent piece in The Atlantic, you know, who sort of view the Soviet Union, Russia and the former Soviet Union as, and Putin as, a potential ally, because from the perspective of these civilizational conservatives that are in the Trump administration, they view the world through the lens of a clash of civilization, where, you know, Islam and Muslims are the big global foe that need to be confronted, and they're the ones that I think are going to be shaping policy. Now, we don't know how this is all going to play out, because there are deep tensions, I think, within the foreign policy advisors that Trump has surrounded himself with. But I think that narrative that comes and is reinforced by the, you know, the alt-right Steve Bannon worldview, if you listen to things that he's been saying, the speeches that he's been given, that whole, you know, civilizational conservative view that views sort of Islam and Muslims as the, you know, the threat facing the world, is now going to, I think, increasingly dominate thinking in the White House. And, you know, Netanyahu, who fits into that picture because they view Israel as sort of an ally in this civilizational fight against, you know, Islam and Muslims. And I think that all bodes very ill for the future of our world. And no one knows how it's going to play out. But I think there's a lot of cause for deep concern over the future of our planet, really, as a result of Donald Trump. And I'm just talking specifically about his Middle East policy, not about, you know, what's happening domestically here in the United States and the, you know, eroding and corruption of what's left of democracy in this country.
But Netanyahu himself has recently praised the emerging relationship between Israel and Arab states, Sunni Arab states like Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia against Iran. So the way I see it is that the Russians are really against Sunni jihadism, and the Russia and Iran are heading into some kind of a de facto alliance, and that the alliances between Trump and Putin will be anti-Sunni as opposed to anti-Shia.
No, you're right. I think there are deep tensions here. I think the alliance, I mean, there's obviously a convergence of interests between the Sunni authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, led by Saudi Arabia and Netanyahu, because they both view Iran as an enemy. And so Iran's greater reach in the Middle East, the expansion of its influence, the Shia crescent, if you will, in one sense does not bode well for Netanyahu and the Sunni Arab monarchies. But I don't think, you know, the expansion of Iranian influence in Syria and Iraq poses a serious or significant threat militarily to Israel. Israel is far more powerful than any of the combination of countries posed against it. And there is this, broad understanding, I think, between Putin and Netanyahu in terms of, you know, where the red lines are that need to be respected. I think the big interesting question here is how far is Putin willing to bring Iran with Russia in terms of this de facto alliance? I think there's going to be a lot of discussions between the Trump administration and Putin over the future of the Middle East, the future of Europe. And I suspect that if Russia gets an offer that is generous and that allows it to, you know, advance its interest globally, they're willing to sort of cut Iran off. I don't see that alliance between, you know, Tehran and Moscow being rooted in very sort of, you know, long. I think it's an alliance of convenience for now, particularly over Syria. But I don't think it has, you know, deep roots and deep, you know, I don't see it as a relationship that, you know, will really stand the test of time. And I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, what direction the Trump administration wants to move in with respect to its Middle East policy, because the alliance with Putin over Syria does imply a deep tension with respect to Iran. Many of the close foreign policy advisors in the Trump administration are deeply antagonistic and extremely hawkish toward Iran. And they've gone on record as sort of saying, and I'm not just talking about, you know, John Bolton, who's in favor of bombing Iran, but the Rudolf Giulianis, the Newt Gingriches, and specifically the one figure who I think here is the most dangerous among all of these cast of characters is the new National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, who is extremely, I think, not only, you know, paranoid with respect to Iran, but he did co-author this book on the Middle East with Michael Ledeen, who is one of these extreme, you know, neoconservative hawks on Iran. And if you listen to what all of these people are saying, and I'm including Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense as well, who's, you know, had hawkish things to say about Iran as well, these people view Iran as sort of the major threat. And I think they're going to move in the direction of trying to sort of, you know, limit Iran's regional expansion. And what that means for the relationship with the Soviet Union and with Putin, Hasn't been, I think, worked out, but I think this is going to be one of the big internal debates within the Trump administration over U.S. policy toward the Middle East. And so those tensions are there. But I don't think getting back to Israel, that Israel has much to worry about. They're perfectly happy to see sort of the focus of the Middle East directed at Iran, Iraq, Syria, and away from Israel and what it's doing on the West Bank. And everything that we know with respect to, you know, the Trump administration and Israel shows that, you know, Netanyahu is going to be very happy with a new Middle East policy because, you know, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, comes from the right wing of the pro-Israel perspective to the right of Netanyahu. There's talk of moving the embassy to Jerusalem. I suspect there's going to be greater attempts to annex or conquer more of the West Bank, and the United States is not going to utter a word of protest under a Trump administration. So all of this looks very good from, I think, Netanyahu's perspective, notwithstanding the obvious sort of, you know, apparent tension that Iran's rising influence does not work in Netanyahu's favor. But I think, militarily speaking, the balance of power in the Middle East is not at this moment jeopardizing, you know, Israel's influence and its position in the region.
Well, notwithstanding the influence that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, has, and Adelson, of course, is also weighing in heavily in favor of John Bolton, as are the Mercer family, who are the biggest donors to Trump's campaign. They're all pushing heavy the Israel right-wing Likud neocon agenda. But then you do have countervailing forces, and I'm not sure entirely. Certainly, you know, in effect, it's really Putin who may well dictate the future of American foreign policy. And just one thing about Israel's strategic situation under this changing condition where Iran will be at its doorstep and have free access through Iraq, Syria, and into Lebanon, Hezbollah is still the one group of anti-Israel fanatics who can really cause damage to Israel.
That's true, and that's why I think Iran is so heavily invested in ensuring that it wins in Syria, because from Iran's national security perspective, if Assad were to be toppled, that would have huge consequences for their ability to assist their major ally in the region, which is Hezbollah. And Iran views as the existence of Hezbollah as sort of a guarantor, as a form of deterrence against any possible American or Israeli strike. So Hezbollah's presence in Lebanon, I think, is, if anything, it's increasing. I mean, it hasn't been weakened, and the new Lebanese president has also worked in Hezbollah's favor. But there is, I think, a balance of forces, or there's a certain understanding in terms of the status quo between Israel and Hezbollah as a result of the recent wars that have taken place. So Israel, I think, is perfectly happy with maintaining that understanding with Hezbollah over its position in the Middle East. But it does, you know, raise serious questions that, you know, if there ever is going to be an attempt to attack Iran or limit its influence, and Iran feels that it's under severe threat, it hopes that it could rely on Hezbollah to attack Israel as a form of deterrence capacity. So that's still there. But I don't think, you know, these recent developments in Aleppo, you know, are really any cause for concern from Israel's perspective or from Netanyahu's perspective. I think they are basically happy with what's happening in Washington. There always has been an internal debate in Israel in terms of how to view, you know, the future of Syria. Assad was, you know, an adversary. But he was an adversary who had an understanding with Israel in terms of, you know, the balance of forces in the region. I think Israel was much more worried about a post-Assad, you know, regime that would come into power that was, you know, controlled by, you know, various Syrian nationalist forces. That's increasingly less of a likelihood. Assad will be in power. And, you know, yes, that's Iran's ally, but, you know, Assad is not... he has his own, you know, strategic calculations that he makes with respect to Israel. And so I don't think Israel has much to be concerned about with these recent turn of events. They're looking very good, and they're, I think, incredibly excited. I'm speaking about Netanyahu now in particular. They're incredibly excited about the coming to power of Donald Trump and what that will mean for advancing Netanyahu's agenda in the region.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He is the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. And his forthcoming book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking at how Putin's cyber warriors are now switching their attention to sabotaging the German elections in 2017. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. A member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences, he worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you very much. It's always good to hear you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Anders. And this extraordinary situation vis-a-vis Russia's hacking, where NBC News is now saying that Vladimir Putin himself personally hands-on managed and oversaw the hacking operation against this recent election here in the United States, apparently because he harbors such a deep animus towards Hillary Clinton. He basically not only targeted her, but he also targeted some Democratic congresspeople, one of whom lost an election in Florida. Have you ever seen anything like this in terms of the brazen nature of it?
No, when you talk to intelligence people here in Washington, they say that they are very surprised that Russia uses its intelligence so openly. Normally, you know, intelligence people, they want to keep everything secret, as the CIA and FBI people now do. They don't want to say anything. And the Russians come out brazenly and tell us what they have been doing.
So, in other words, Putin is proud. I mean, I guess for an intelligence officer, this is a real feather in your cap, isn't it? To basically get your guy in the White House. In other words, to put somebody that you prefer literally in charge of what you as a KGB officer were brought up to believe is the main adversary.
Indeed, and it's used for political purposes in Russia. Levada Center, the last independent poster that has been labeled a foreign agent in Russia, measured, we don't know how well you can measure the public opinion now in Russia, that Putin's popularity increased from 81% to 86% after Trump's election, because this was celebrated on Russian television as a major victory of Russia. So the main propaganda program in the first Russian channel they had on their Sunday talk show, Dmitry Kiselyov, the worst propagandist who's sanctioned by the U.S., saying that we Russians now congratulate one another on Trump's victory.
So, yet Trump himself is trying to deny the obvious.
Indeed. And his problem is that it is obvious. The CIA has come clean. 17 intelligence agencies have come clean. Whom you would rely upon most in these matters is the national security agencies, since they actually listen to a lot of things, so that they really know. I would guess that the main information here comes from NSA, while FBI, that doesn't have that operation. They are basically only operating within the United States. They don't know, so they say, we can't really know. And if one agency has really been discredited now, it's, of course, the FBI, and Comey's very strange behavior.
So now that this has all happened, and my understanding, the genesis of this in Russia has a lot to do with the purging of some of the top people, particularly Sergei Ivanov, who was Vladimir Putin's chief of staff and head of the presidential administration. And he's an old KGB colleague of Putin's. And apparently he's gotten rid of a lot of his old KGB colleagues who are able to talk to him reasonably and rationally and out of long experience and personal friendship. And he's hired a bunch of much younger, somewhat sycophantic people like the younger Anton Vano, who replaced Ivanov. And one of the problems I understand is that a lot of these younger people around him, first of all, are eager and sycophantic, but they also don't remember the Soviet Union that well, and they don't understand why it really collapsed under its own weight. And that they bought into Putin's narrative, which I'm afraid most of Russia has bought into, that Russia's greatness was stolen from it by the West.
Yeah, and what has happened very much now is that President Putin has become the lone ruler. So previously, for example, when the action on Crimea was decided in February 2014, it came out very clearly that there were four top people, all KGB generals, including Putin, who decided this. And while it appears that the action in Syria was decided by one single person. So I heard recently from some Russian old foreign policy specialists and said that we never thought that we would say this, but we actually miss the Soviet Union now. When Brezhnev decided to go into Afghanistan in December 79, there were four people who decided. When Putin decided to go into to Syria, he alone decided to do this. So to a considerable extent, President Putin is out of control, that he does it all on his own, and then you make mistake. Having said that, we just saw that the Minister of Economy was sacked by one of his KGB cronies, Igor Sechin, who's head of a Russian state oil company, Rosneft, the biggest oil company in the world. That is traded on stock markets. And after he had done that, Putin appointed a minister of economy that was even more orthodox liberal economist to balance Sechin. So Putin has not completely lost it, but he is he can do lots of things very fast on his own now.
Well, apparently, after this successful coup of getting Donald Trump into the White House, Putin is now turning his attention to Germany. And we already know the German Bundestag in May of 2015 was hacked. Its servers were compromised. It shut down the lower house's parliament's computer for several days, and that was a Russian hack. And now, just only about 3 weeks ago, hackers shut down Deutsche Telekom and disabled the internet and phone service for almost a million customers in Germany. And now we have Chancellor Angela Merkel, along with the head of German foreign intelligence, warning that the Russians are going to hack next year's parliamentary elections in Germany. So obviously the means to hack an election here in the United States and hack into the grid and into major servers, cut down telephone, internet service, all of those things are equally capable, the Russians are equally capable of. It's just a question of intent in terms of what you target. So having already targeted our elections, they have also shown that they are prepared to be more aggressive in Western Europe, in particularly Germany. So do you think this is going to get nasty?
It is nasty, and it will get worse. Before, there was a completely fabricated story in Germany that led to demonstrations that a 13-year-old German-Russian girl in Germany had been raped, and there was no such rape. It was a completely invented story, but that led to thousands of Russian Germans in Berlin taking to the street in protest against this action. That was reported on Russian television. And the situation in Germany is politically quite complicated. Of course, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of the Christian Democratic Union, the center-right party, is very popular. She's very strong. But all around her, she has parties that oppose her. The Social Democrats have become very cozy with Russia, in particular after the former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder went on the payroll of Gazprom at a very high salary. And also the Christian Socialist Union, which is a partner party of Angela Merkel in Bavaria, is very positive on Putin. So she has enemies all around, and this results in the German Minister for Foreign Affairs pursuing a pro-Russian policy, while in the end, Angela Merkel's chancellery comes down on the opposite direction. And it's even taking such petty expressions as President Putin having figured out that Angela Merkel, as a little girl, had an accident with a big dog. So then he takes his big black Labrador, Coney, to meetings with Angela Merkel and has his big Labrador disturbing her. And he knows that she strongly dislikes it, but he insists on doing it whenever he can.
Right. I've seen pictures of those meetings with Angela Merkel looking in absolute terror at Putin's big dog. I thank you, Anders Östlund. We've run out of time, but I always appreciate talking with you.
Thank you, Ian. As always, very nice to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Anders Östlund, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences and worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.